The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Our aim is to explore the fringe, lost civilizations, alternative science, the paranormal, and much more. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live or future guests via email or the live chat room. And remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. And now welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And this week on Where Did the Road Go? We have Rand Flamoth, who has written two books on Atlantis and its possible location, and books I really, really enjoyed. And Rand, are you there with us?
I sure am.
All right. And you have two, well, I guess we could say two and a half books at this point. You wrote When the Sky Fell back in the 90s, right?
Yes, 1995.
And then The Atlantis Blueprint. And then you re-released When the Sky Fell as Atlantis Beneath the Ice.
Yes, that was last year, yeah.
Okay, and you're pretty much the person who has mainly suggested that Atlantis could be in Antarctica.
Yeah, that's my claim to fame, I guess. I also do a lot of work on Earth crust displacement, which is the mechanism which we believe caused Atlantis to become Antarctica.
Okay, and how did you get into all of this?
I was working in the library, and one of the books that came across the I'm a librarian, first of all, and one of the books that came across was a book by Charles Hapgood called Maps of the Ancient Sea Kings, in which he proposed that there was a civilization in the an ancient civilization at the time of the Ice Age. That was destroyed, and that a lot of these maps that existed in the European museums and libraries in the 16th century actually depicted the world accurately before the Europeans had explored them. And so that got me interested in the whole subject, and I eventually got into the question of Atlantis, which was Plato's account of a lost civilization that existed 11,500 years ago. And I was intrigued by the fact that the story of Atlantis, as told by Plato, pinpointed the destruction of Atlantis at exactly the time that modern radiocarbon dating and science has determined was the termination of the last ice age. And so that was what got me interested in it, and I eventually started corresponding with Charles Hapgood, and he became my kind of mentor. And from there, I just started to explore different parts of the story, the Lost Island Paradise, world mythology, the origins of agriculture, all the extinctions that were happening around this time, just a whole series of different sciences that with my skills as a librarian, I was able to just go into. And so that kept me busy for quite a while.
I bet.
I also managed, because my wife, who's a co-author of my books, was English, we were able to go to London, and I was able to use the British Museum Library there, became a reader there. And that allowed me to get books very, very quickly that would have otherwise taken many days to get, even months to get in Canada. I could get order up just about any book you can imagine and have it on my desk within an hour, which was just an amazing thing.
Wow. What would you say the time frame was for writing the first book?
Well, I started in 1976. The book was completed was published in 1995, so 19 years.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And it is how much does the re-release differ from the original?
Well, there's so much happened since 1995, for one thing, the internet. Just the incredible amounts of scientific evidence that has come forward since then. New sites have been discovered around the world, archaeological sites that call into a question a lot of the assumptions that we have about the ancient world. We believe that that there was an advanced civilization that existed some 11,500 years ago that was destroyed in a global catastrophe, a global geological catastrophe that basically just wiped out civilization on a global scale. And the remnants of that civilization, which for better any term, we use many different terms, but we use Plato's Atlantis as the term. The remnants of that civilization had struggled to survive, and right at the time that, right after this great event, this great geological catastrophe, suddenly around the world, in different parts of the world, using different animals and plants, agriculture began. And we don't think that that was a coincidence. We think that that was a direct result of the survivors of Atlantis bringing the skills of it, of domestication to various parts of the world simultaneously.
Right. And
so,
go on.
So, just to tell you, while corresponding with Charles Hapgood to develop it, he had developed his theory of Earth crust displacement in cooperation with and under the guidance, really, of Albert Einstein. And they worked together through correspondence, and they met once in person, but they corresponded for 2.5 years before Einstein died, and they developed this theory of Earth crust displacement, which is a radical shift of the entire outer shell of the Earth as one unit that moves the crust to a different position than it was before. And what Hapgood determined was that before the last Earth crust displacement, the part of the crust that was over the North Pole, or the axis, was in the Hudson Bay in Canada, and that's why we have all that ice in North America nearly 12,000 years ago, like most of New York and all the states that are border the Great Lakes were under ice, even a mile of ice. In fact, the Great Lakes are the remnants of that ice sheet. And but there was other parts of while that part of the Earth's surface was within the polar zone, within the Arctic Circle, other parts like Alaska and Siberia were not. They were temperate. So it actually was warmer in Siberia during the last ice age than it is today. And if when you look at the opposite side of the Earth to Siberia, that takes you to the western part of Antarctica. And we believe that the part of Antarctica towards South America was temperate 11,500 years ago and was the site of an advanced civilization, which Plato called Atlantis.
Now, what did Plato exactly say about Atlantis that supports it being in Antarctica?
Well, that's the really interesting thing. First of all, he said it was an island, and then he said it was larger than North Africa and Libya combined. So you have to know what these terms meant to Plato. This North Africa would be the same as North Africa today. They called it Libya in those days. And Asia, which would be like the Middle East. So we're looking at an island continent the size of North Africa and the Middle East combined, which is almost exactly the size of Antarctica. And then he said it was in the real ocean, which he also called the Atlantic Ocean. And that is, this has been the big stumbling block for people looking for Atlantis in our view. The term Atlantic meant something different in Plato's time and for the Greeks than it does today. Today, the Atlantic refers to the body of water between Europe and North America. That's the North Atlantic, and then there's the South Atlantic. And but in the time of Plato, when he was writing about Atlantis, the term Atlantic meant a body of water that went all the way around the world. They perceived themselves as being an island with Libya, Asia, and Europe being a sort of a big disc in the middle of this vast ocean. And that beyond this, beyond the Pillars of Hercules, another behind, beyond the Mediterranean Sea, this real ocean, as he called it, was vast, and we believe that the description that is given in Plato's account of Atlantis is an accurate depiction of the Earth's geography as seen from Antarctica. That's people who want to take a look at that in terms of visual things can see that on our website, Flemeth.com. There's a section called Atlantis in Antarctica. So the thing about Plato's account is this. He says that it's an account that he received from his ancestor, who in turn received it from an Egyptian priest. The Egyptian priest said that he received it from records that were 9,000 years old. And this conversation took place between Plato's ancestor Solon and this Egyptian priest about 600 BC. So that places the destruction of Atlantis at 9,600 BC. And that is exactly, as I said before, the date at which which geologists now call the end of the late Pleistocene and the beginning of the Holocene, the modern time. So it's the time when there was vast climatic changes happening around the world, particularly like in North America, for example, the ice sheets that began to rapidly melt. There was vast extinctions of animals. There was the commencement of agriculture in Mexico. Early experiments with plants and animals in South America. All around the world, there's vast changes happening, and the ocean level is rising, and it continues to rise. It rises 100 meters in the end, so that land equivalent to modern day Africa was lost. Mm. So all the world's continental shelves before the destruction of Atlantis was land. So that like England was part of Europe. There was no sea between England and France, for example. It was land.
Right.
Same thing in Japan. Japan was connected to the mainland. And then as the ice sheets melted in North America and in Antarctica, the ocean level rose, and we got the new configuration of what we have today.
Okay. Now, Antarctica and Siberia were both warm, or not all of Antarctica, but lesser Antarctica seemed to have been ice-free and fairly warm during the last ice age, as Siberia did. And
yes.
How does popular science, how does mainstream science explain that?
Well, the current theory of ice ages assumes that the overall temperature of the planet goes down, and that it gets colder and colder out from the pole, so that the pole area then encroaches on the temperate zones. The temperate zones get colder, and that's the model of a sort of a expanding out from the pole thing. But we believe that is a misconception of what the ice ages are. Both Albert Einstein, Charles Hapgood, and in the work that I've done, we assume that there's always an ice age, because we believe the ice age is equal to and is exactly the same as being in the Arctic Circle or the Antarctic Circle. So the polar zones are the same. It's just that the Earth's crust as a whole shifts in and out of those areas. And if you're in them, as Siberia is today, you're experiencing an ice age. And if you're out of them, as you are, say, in New York or Michigan today, you're out of it. 12,000 years ago, you were in it. Now you're out of it. So we say that the ice ages have been misconceived as being changes in temperature, whereas really the variable is the whole outer shell of the Earth shifting in and out of the polar zones.
Okay. Now, we had a guest on last week named Randall Carlson. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him.
No.
But one of the things he talked about is just how quickly the ice melted at the end of the last ice age. Apparently, science can't account for the speed at which it melted.
No, they cannot. And that's because they're assuming that everything is gradual. The whole science of geology was founded in under this theory of gradualism, or it came to be known as uniformitarianism. It's that change is always slow and gradual. Einstein said directly to Hapgood that that was a habit of mind and wasn't based upon the facts. Hapgood went on to show that climatic change can happen much more abruptly than the gradualist assumptions of the prevailing theories of geology. And we believe that the prevailing theories of geology, which are called uniformitarianism, is obsolete. That is a paradigm that we think will ultimately be exposed for being a failure. And there's all sorts of physical evidence that falsifies it, particularly, and most interestingly, as we explain in Atlantis Beneath the Ice, 33,000 years ago in Siberia at what today is latitude 71 degrees north, that is well within the Arctic Circle, there were people living with all sorts of temperate adapted animals. The animals that couldn't live even 1 year in a polar zone. This was reported by 9 members of the Russian Academy of Science in Nature magazine, which is one of the world's leading scientific journals. That the existence of it's a place called Yana. The existence of Yana 33,000 years ago falsifies the theory of overall temperatures changing as accounting for ice ages.
Okay. there's one of the things you talk about in the book, too, is a place called Tierra de Fuego, a small island down at the base of South America.
Oh, yes, right. Yes, it's one of the locations where there was human occupation around within 100 years of the destruction of Atlantis.
Okay, and their culture actually goes right back further than anything else we're aware of, doesn't it?
Their culture is very old. Their language is very old. We don't know a lot about it, but it doesn't seem to fit into the current model of how people arrived in America, because it's very, very old. I mean, it's old as the ones that we're finding in North America. As it turns out, we're finding that the oldest sites in the Americas are just, there's as many old sites in South America as there is in North America. And some of the oldest sites, like the ones discovered by archaeologist Tom Dillahay in central South America, are way older than the traditional models of the peopling of America assume. So The theories about what has happened in America archaeologically are under assault by physical facts coming forward from South America, and I believe that ultimately it will be shown, and that's what we're arguing in Atlantis Beneath the Ice, is that South America was populated before North America, and the people that came there came from Antarctica.
Yeah, which is a revolutionary idea.
It's certainly different from what is the prevailing notion right now. That's true.
And they tried to kind of bury, like, I know there were footprints found in lava down in Central America that turned out to be anatomically modern humans. And the woman who discovered it, although she did everything correctly, they were too old to be accepted by mainstream science, and she was kind of blackballed out of her profession.
Yes, some people have been treated abysmally, even though they're following scientific principles that are well established.
But
just because the prevailing the idea of a paradigm is what we're talking about. It's a way of thinking about things. It's a school of thought, if you like. The schools of thought get entrenched. They're not easily bent, and people will defend them vigorously, or they will tend to ignore any evidence that doesn't support them. And that's what's happening around the world in geology and in archaeology and even in paleontology in terms of the extinctions. We believe that that 11,500 years ago, amazing extinctions occurred in North and South America, but not in Africa, not in the South Pacific. And that is explicable by an earth crust displacement, because an earth crust displacement has a differential rate around the world. And here's how you might want to conceive it. If you have a basketball in your hand where your palms are facing each other, and then you rotate your wrists, you'll notice that the ball moves the most around your nose. Okay, so that was like where North America was and South America was and Antarctica was and Siberia was. That was changing a lot during this displacement of the Earth's crust. But the areas that were near your palms, like the Congo in Africa and the South Pacific Islands, hardly were moving at all. So there's no the extinctions of massive animals in North America, like mammoths and horses and rhinoceroses, goes on. But in Africa, those animals survive. And the reason is the changes in the latitude are less in Africa than they are in North America and South America. So that's just one thing that's happening with earth crust displacement in terms of an explanation of extinctions. It's simultaneously explaining the locations where agriculture is occurring. For example, in South America, there's a Lake Titicaca in the highlands of the Andes. It's a very ancient site. There's pyramids there. There's ancient monuments there. And this land was 1,000 miles north of the equator and ended up 1,000 miles south of the equator. So it had the same relationship to the equator as it did both before and after. And that made that area an oasis for survival. And that's where potatoes were first domesticated and a bunch of other crops. And this is where civilizations reemerged in South America. Right there. Now, if you go exactly through the middle of the Earth from Lake Titicaca, you'll be on the other side of the Earth and around the area of Thailand. And there, the same thing had happened. The relationship to the equator had shifted from in terms of hemispheres, but not in terms of distance. And that's where rice was domesticated. So in terms of agricultural origins, Earth crust displacement is bringing order to the chaos that is otherwise there without the theory. Hmm. So what we're saying with the earth crust displacement theory, and this is why Albert Einstein was so interested in it, is that with a simple notion, replacing a solid earth's crust with a mobile crust that moves over, bear in mind that more than 99% of the earth's mass doesn't change. It's not like the axis is changing. It's sometimes called a pole shift. It's not a pole shift. The shift, the axis remains pointing at the same stars both before and after an earth crust displacement. It's the outer crust as a whole, including the ocean basins. If you imagine a orange and you take off the peel and then you attach the orange, reattach the peel, it's the peel that's moving, but not the flesh of the orange. And this is what's happening with an earth crust displacement. The entire outer shell of the earth is shifting, and as it shifts towards the pole, you go into an ice age. And if you're leaving the pole, you're leaving an ice age. North America was leaving an ice age. Siberia was going into an ice age.
So basically you're saying that ice ages are just more of a local phenomenon.
Ice ages are are those parts of the Earth's crust that are in the polar zone.
Okay.
So or in the either Arctic Circle or the Antarctic Circle.
Now, there are a bunch of different theories as to what would have caused the pole shift. I know Einstein had his,
yes,
even though he didn't think it was necessarily right.
Einstein outlined what he thought would be the requirements of a theory that could explain an earth crust displacement. And he thought that it needed a steady force of some sort. He didn't believe that something like an asteroid or a comet hitting the Earth would be sufficient to cause an Earth crust displacement. He was looking for a force that would be over a little bit of period of time. And as I said, Charles Hapgood had abandoned looking for the mechanism. There's a fellow in Florida named Jared Friedman who's come up with a theory called solar typhoons. And he suggests that the sun periodically has just as the Earth has hurricanes and typhoons, so also the sun has these storms as well, but they're on a longer period of time, and they're longer than what science has observed the sun with. And he believes that that occasionally there can be electromagnetic storms that hit the Earth, which itself is a magnet, and could cause the Earth's crust to shift. It's a detailed thing, and it's not something that a lot of your listeners might be into. But I will say this, it's recorded very graphically in world mythology, where you have stories around the world saying the same thing about the Great Flood. And they're saying before the Great Flood, there was either a falling of the sky, when the sky fell was the name of our first book, or a change in the path of the sun. Perhaps the one that Plato related to the destruction of Atlantis was the story of Phaeton, and it's just as good a story as any. I'll give you that story. Phaeton was believed to be the son of Helios, the sun god, and in Greek mythology, the sun god rode a chariot of flying horses and dragged the sun behind him each day. So that's how they accounted for the sun from rising and setting, and then he would go around the other side of the earth and then come back and ride the chariot again, dragging the sun behind it. The story of Phaeton Phaeton claimed to be Helios's son. But his friends didn't believe him, so he traveled to the edge of the world and asked Helios to prove to his buddies that he was indeed the son of Helios the god. And Helios says, "Well, yes, you are my son. What would you like me to do?" And Phaeton said, "I would like to be able to drive the sun across the sky one day." And Helios says, "Well, I don't think you're really up to that." But Phaeton says, "No, I want to do it." And so Helios had to let him do it. So here's Phaeton, this young boy, young man, not as strong as Helios, in the chariot of the sun, and the horses are flying across the sky, and the sun is being dragged behind them. And they sense his weakness, so they veer from the normal path, and as they do, the sun starts to scorch the earth. So at that point, Zeus, the main god, intervenes and brings a flood to bring the end of the destruction of the earth by fire. So that is a story, what I call a sun deluge story. That story is told around the world. It's not just Plato. It's all across the globe. And as I studied stories of the flood, I focused on the ones that told what was happening before the flood. And the thing that comes up with these sun deluge things is that the sun seems to veer from its path. And what we say is, as the Earth's crust is shifting, the sun seems to rise on a different horizon every day. So you get the effect, the illusion that the sun is veering from its path when really it's the Earth's crust shifting. And this story appears in North America, it appears in South America, it's in Russia, it's all around the world we find these stories of the sun being responsible for the flood. Or in other cases, they say the stars are falling. So this idea we believe that world mythology are real witness accounts of a real event. And the real event was the last Earth crust displacement. And it was perceived as though the sky was falling rather than the Earth's crust shifting. So that's a whole area of research that we explore in Atlantis Beneath the Ice.
Okay. And now Robert Schock has a theory that what ended the Ice Age ultimately was a massive solar flare, like an outburst from the sun, that would have been enough to actually melt the ice caps. And would that fit in with your theory, do you think?
Well, certainly I believe that a solar, even in my the very first paper that I published in 1981 was on the global origins of agriculture, and in that I ended the paper saying that I thought that the solar activity was probably the ultimate cause of these things. So yes, I do think that it was it could very well have been a solar activated earth crust displacement, and the person who put that together first was Jared Friedman. Schock is all up on that research, and he's not proposing an earth crust displacement. He's just proposing straightforward heat from the sun melting the ice.
Right.
I don't think that works, frankly. I think that to be able to explain the melting of the ice caps in North America and the great ice sheets in Antarctica, specifically the ice sheets that were in the Indian Ocean, South Indian Ocean, requires a change in climate, a permanent change in climate. And earth crust displacement as a theory provides a permanent change in climate. So the areas that were polar, like New York, which were in the polar zone, mm-hmm. and now are in the temperate zone, melted all their ice over very quickly initially, but it still took 6,000 years to melt it all. So it wasn't like a flash melting, like the sun just coming and flash melting. I believe that the solar flare or the electromagnetic force from the sun hit the Earth at one of the poles, directed the energy into the center of the core. The core heated up, that heated up the mantle, and then below the Earth's crust, there's an area called the asthenosphere, which is normally very sticky and tarry, and it turned liquid, and that allowed the Earth's crust to shift. And so that's what we believe happened 11,500 years ago, and also. Before that, 41,000 years before that, and that there'd been three earth crust displacements in the last 100,000 years, and Hapgood believed there's been over 200 earth crust displacements in the Earth's history.
Okay, we got to take a quick break, and we're going to come back in 45 seconds with Rand Flemmath. You want to give people your website again real quick?
It's Flemmath. It's like Fleming taking a bath, FLEM-ATH.com.
Okay, and we'll be back with Rand in 45 seconds.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live guests via email or the live chat room. You can also check out our upcoming schedule, blog, link section, book reviews, videos, and links to our Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and much more. That's wheredidtheroadgo.com.
And we are talking to Rand Flemmath. And if you have any questions for him, go to wheredidtheroadgo.com and come into our chat, and I will relay them. You there, Rand?
I am.
All right, good, because the internet's definitely not our friend tonight. Now, there are other people who... For instance, the Littles and Andrew Collins, who put Atlantis in the Caribbean. What's the problem with their theory, do you think, that makes Atlantis more likely than a Caribbean answer?
Well, Plato's account says that Atlantis was larger than Libya and Asia combined. That's larger than North Africa and the Middle East combined. You can't put an island continent that size even in the Atlantic Ocean, let alone in the Caribbean. So the size is way too small. The size of Atlantis, as described by Plato, is too big to fit in, even into the Atlantic Ocean. If you want to see where a continent of that size can exist, it's in the World Ocean. And there's only one ocean, oceanographers now recognize that there's only one ocean. If you take a globe, any globe, and you take a look at Antarctica and you ask yourself the question, what ocean is this in? If you have to use European notions, you're saying it's in the Indian Ocean, it's in the Pacific Ocean, and it's in the South Atlantic Ocean. But there's no physical divisions between those pieces of water. The reality is that the Earth only has one ocean, the world ocean. This is what oceanographers have been teaching for the past 20 years. And it's the story, and that's it contained within Atlantis's, the story of Atlantis that Plato gives. He says that Atlantis is an island continent in the middle of the real ocean. And there's only one candidate that fits that, and that is Antarctica.
And I'm also always amused by the people who the more scientific people who will support the Crete theory, and they act like, well, you got to take all Plato's statements in, and you can't discard any of them, and then they kind of twist them out of shape to make to make their theory fit. It's like, now wait a minute,
how do you get an island? How do you get an island the size of North Africa and the Middle East into the Mediterranean? You can't do it. It's just not possible.
Well, I like what you had to say about the math too. That although for us, if you just take a zero away, it doesn't look like a big difference. It could have been an easy mistake. They weren't using the same math system.
No, and also this theory, which the Mediterranean theorists of Atlantis conveniently go to, the idea of some sort of decimal error of not 10,000 but 1,000. Hey, well, the story was related to Plato's ancestor Solon by an Egyptian. They didn't have the decimal system. There's no mistaking 10,000 from 1,000 in Greek hieroglyphics. And that's what he was using when he was relating the story to Solon, who then passed it ultimately on to Plato, and Plato wrote it down. So the decimal system is an anachronism to say that is it can be used to divide the size of Atlantis by a factor of 10. That's just silly.
All right. Let's talk about your other book a little bit, The Atlantis Blueprint, which is actually the one I read first. Now, the first one you wrote with your wife, and this one you co-authored with Colin Wilson.
That's right.
And how did that come about?
I met Colin at a conference in Delaware, and we both gave lectures at the University of Delaware at a symposium there called Return to the Source Symposium, which had been organized by John Anthony West, and included other authors like Graham Hancock, Robert Bouval, Robert Temple, and we all gave lectures. And at that, I spent a little time with Colin Wilson at that conference, and when I was going to write this book called, originally it was called Blueprints from Atlantis, I thought, well, he would be a good person to work with. So I wrote to him, and he sent him some of the information that I was finding early on, and he said yes right away. And so we got together and we wrote that book together.
Okay, and you want to give people a basic idea what the Atlantis Blueprint is about?
Well, again, it's more further evidence of Earth crust displacement in a different way. There's different layers of it. I'll go at the simplest level first. We believe that after the destruction of Atlantis, there were survivors on ships, and the ships had contained maps. And the other science that was ancient was astronomy, because that's what navies are good at. Navies are good at timekeeping, cartography, and astronomy, and those are the sciences that were the early amongst the earliest. And they, what they had, were they had accurate maps of the Earth's crust, but the ship position of the Earth's crust relative to the Earth's axis had shifted, so their latitudes and longitudes on their maps were all out of kilter. They had to go around the world and start to figure out where their map corresponded to what longitude and latitude. they ultimately came to the decision that they needed a new longitude, a zero longitude. And that they chose Giza in the Great Pyramid. And that and the Great Pyramid is what we call the Giza Prime Meridian. From the Giza Prime Meridian, they were then able to go to the rest of the world, and they would see where, check their maps, and then they would leave sites. They would put up markers that were like, say for example, 120 degrees from Giza to the west. And 120 degrees west of Giza are a bunch of pyramids in Central America. They include Chichen Itza, Copan. There's a couple others. They're all on the same longitude, or what we call meridian. We use Greenwich, London, as zero. But when you put Giza in as zero, then all those ancient sites where there are pyramids that I'm talking about here, Chichen Itza, Copan particularly, Lubantum, they're on the same meridian, but rather than being 89 degrees west of Greenwich, they're 120 degrees west of the Great Pyramid. That's one-third of the distance around the world. Okay, so if we take that now, 120, is there ones at 130? Yes, at 130 is Teotihuacan and Tula. Teotihuacan is where the Great Pyramid is, just north of Mexico City, the Pyramid of the Sun. Mm-hmm. That one is 130. Then you go to 140, that's Easter Island. Now, if you go the other way, 110, it's at Quito on the equator, the northern capital of the Inca Empire. And then at 100, it's at Lake Titicaca, where Teotihuacan is, where all these sites are. So what I'm saying is that these ancient sites in the Americas, at 10-degree intervals from each other, actually coincide with a prime meridian at Giza. And it also happens when you go to the east. For example, Ur of the Bible, or Ur of the Sumerian civilization, is exactly 15 degrees east of the Great Pyramid. And that what that means is that when the sun rises on the horizon and you're on a ziggurat on the top of at Ur, you see the sunrise. At that moment, you have now exactly 1 hour. Later, it's going to rise from seen from the pyramid in Giza. So these 15 degrees things work there. And then Lhasa is 60 degrees east of the pyramid, of the Great Pyramid, and also on the same latitude as Giza, 30 degrees. So what we're seeing in terms of one thing there here is that there are pyramids and monuments, sacred monuments around the world that are all linked to the Great the Giza as a prime meridian. And we believe that happened after the last Earth crust displacement, as part of the process of the Atlanteans trying to remap the Earth. And when they left markers at these places, they were able to recalibrate their maps, and then the maps, which had become incorrect as far as longitude and latitude as a result of the Earth crust displacement, they could then recalibrate using these sites, knowing where they are. Then they abandoned those sites, but they left markers at those sites that the local people, when they saw them, thought were gifts from the gods. And subsequently, as civilizations many thousands of years later, in many cases, arose, they chose those sites as their sacred sites, and they built their monuments there. But we think that they were initially sited there by survivors of Atlantis trying to recalibrate the maps that their navy had kept onto after the destruction of Atlantis.
Now, in the book, you also talk about the sites being aligned to not only the current North Pole, but somehow indicating the previous North Pole.
Absolutely. That's where you're going now into the layer of the onion goes a little bit deeper. It turns out that there are more sacred sites at geometric latitudes. What I mean by geometric latitude is, say, 30 degrees north, like the Great Pyramid is. That's one-third the distance between the equator and the North Pole. That's a geometric thing. It's a third. 15 is a sixth. 45 is a half. So these kind of latitudes that are divide evenly into 360 are what we came to call sacred latitudes. And when you look at the positions, not only were the Atlanteans trying to recalibrate their maps, but they had, before the Earth crust displacement, in anticipation that it might occur again, had put markers around the world trying to calibrate previous Earth crust displacements. And so we have a series of something like 60 sites that work at sacred latitudes when the Earth's crust was in the position that it was at the time of Atlantis. That is when the North Pole, or the crust that was over the axis, to be more accurate, was in 60 degrees north, 83 degrees west, right in the middle of the Hudson Bay. That, if you put that as your North Pole, then you've got a bunch of sites there. For example, the equator at that time included Lhasa, which is now at 30. It was 30 degrees. It was at zero during the time of Atlantis. Easter Island, which is around 27 degrees south, was at that time on the equator. Mohenjo-Daro, one of the most famous and ancient sites in India, was on the equator. There's some underwater site called Aguni off of Japan, underwater. It was on the equator. So you've got these sacred sites on the equator of today, but when the Earth's crust was in a different position. Hmm. So this indicates that the Atlanteans had marked off the sacred sites of their latitude, of the world as it was at their time.
But now, you said something that it might also be aligned to the pole shift before that.
They did. I believe that they did a geological survey and tried to recreate what the conditions were before in earlier Earth crust displacements, including two earlier Earth crust displacements, going back nearly 100,000 years. So they might made markers at those places as well. So you have other sacred sites at the equator in earlier positions of the crust. For example, Nazca, Machu Picchu, Cuzco, Abydos, Byblos. These were all on the equator when the pole was in the Yukon. So what we're saying is that that there was an advanced civilization in Antarctica that was aware and that it wasn't maybe even the first advanced civilization. It could have been a series of advanced civilizations that occurred there. And they were interested in geology because they understood that the Earth's crust periodically is displaced. So they were exploring that and leaving markers around the world. And they were also leaving caches, I believe, at places like Cuzco in South America of information, sort of a time capsule, if you like, but also mm-hmm. real things there, knowledge at places like Cuzco. And when you go into the mythology of the people of South America, they talk about having their earlier leaders and kings having a wand of some sort that led them in a direction towards some place. And when they got there, it was stuck itself in the ground, and that became Cuzco. Hmm. And then they dug up whatever was left there for them and transported it to the equator, the new equator, at Quito in Ecuador. because they knew that the safest place to be on the planet is at high altitude at the equator. You're not subject to being thrown into a polar zone, and you're above the area where the tidal waves can take you.
Right.
So Quito became the northern capital, and the Inca Trail, which leads from Cuzco to Quito, was constructed for the purpose of transporting information from the southern capital of Cuzco to the northern capital of Quito. And that's what ultimately linked the Inca Empire.
Hmm.
So the influence of the Atlanteans is there upon civilization. So how much of that was technological, we don't know. It probably was they could have had pictographic things about domestication or something, because we have the origins of agriculture occurring at this time. So it's all seems to be linking together. The theory of Earth crust displacement, we believe, is a scientific revolution, and that it, because it can solve so many long-standing problems in science, like that are just at bottlenecks, if you like explaining the extinctions of North America and South America 11,000 years ago, the rise of agriculture, the glaciation patterns, and all those standard problems that the uniformitarian theorists cannot explain, Earth crust displacement can explain. Moreover, it throws up new types of avenues of investigation, such as ancient maps that exist prior to the age of European exploration that are accurate, and it explains world mythology in terms of the sun deluge myths, the lost island paradise myths, which I haven't even got into, but those stories all relate, all become coherent by the simple adoption of the idea that the Earth's crust can periodically and dramatically shift. Once you accept that as a hypothesis, and then you test it against the evidence, it resolves these scientific problems that have been around for 50, 60, 70, sometimes 100 years. And that's why Albert Einstein was so enthusiastic when he first, he said that when he first got his first communication with Charles Hapgood, he said it electrified me because it was so simple. And it's the simplicity of the idea and the vast scope of the idea that makes it so appealing as an avenue of scientific investigation, at least it has been for me.
Right. Okay. Well, we're almost out of time. I have a couple quick things to ask you. One, how advanced do you think Atlantis might have been?
In terms of cartography, they were very advanced. They had mapped the world. So to map the world, we didn't get to that until 18th, 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
That mapping the world requires a certain amount of sophistication. Like we need marine chronometers to do that, which are highly advanced clocks, if you like, that they don't even lose a second over a year kind of thing. But we really can't know. Plato tantalizes us with the stories of the engineering construction at the city of Atlantis, which is a city on the island continent of Atlantis. And that city was vast. It was the size of modern-day London. And the engineering feats that he describes, if accurate, would dwarf things that we see on the Earth today, like the Great Pyramids, and any of the great monuments on the Earth's surface today. Someday, perhaps, we will, as the ice starts, is continually melting in Antarctica, maybe we will find, some of these evidence of that geometric structures that were constructed at the time that Plato says that they were.
Yeah.
So as the answer to your question is, they were at least advanced to map the world.
Okay. All right. And to build stuff that, I mean, we couldn't even build the Great Pyramid today the way they built it. So obviously there was some knowledge kept over that was fairly advanced.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that the Atlanteans built the Great Pyramid. I think that...
No, but I'm saying the knowledge that they had was probably left over, and that's what helped build it.
Yes, there certainly seems to have been a silent hand around 6,000 years ago around the planet that started to, including the megaliths of Europe, as well as all around the world. There seems to be a lot of events happening around 6,000 years ago.
And at the end of the Atlantis blueprint, you actually have a tantalizing little tease about them finding something under the ice, some circular metal structures.
Yeah, we found an article that said, a scientific article that said that there was a strikingly circular object at this specific location. Could very well be the site of the city of Atlantis.
Okay, one last quick thing. Your theory has spawned a lot of ideas in fiction and other stuff, like Stargate placed part of Atlantis, and you had Alien versus Predator.
Yeah, Stargate Atlantis. The whole Stargate stuff. The idea that Antarctica might be the site of a lost civilization is now more widespread as a result of our work.
And how does that make you feel, that those big fictional things have taken up your idea and run with it?
Well, that's a great idea. That's wonderful. I think that's great. I would hope that there are more of it. It's fun. I mean, I think it's great.
All right. Awesome. And I think you said in your book you got a tour of the MGM studios?
Yeah, we sure did. A private tour. It was very fun. It was very nice to see a lot of the stuff there. That was a nice treat. Nothing came of it, but it was fun to go there.
And that was for Stargate.
That was with Roland Emmerich's studio.
Oh, okay. Okay.
The guy that did 2012.
Oh, okay. All right.
Independence Day.
Right. And you had a little bit of they referenced or they talked to you a little about the 2012 movie too, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. Well, they needed also some things like the picture of Hapgood. I provided that for them.
Ah, nice. Yeah. All right. And once again, people can follow you on your website. Where?
It's Flemath. It's like Fleming with a bath. FLEM-ATH.com.
All right. And your most recent book, technically, is the re-release of When the Sky Fell, Atlantis Beneath the Ice.
Right.
And you have the Atlantis Blueprint. And you do a couple works of fiction with your wife as well, right?
Yes, we've written a thriller called The Headhunters, which is based upon some original research about what might have happened to the Ark of the Covenant. Mm. And we also did a mystery called When She Was Alive.
Nice. Okay. Well, maybe we can have you on again at some point, because I'm pretty sure we just scratched the surface here.
Well, I'd be happy to.
All right. Thank you, Rand. And taking us out with some Psyche Corporation. Last Exit for the Lost is up next.
Come in. Come in. Do you read me? Do you understand the numbers pouring over your connection? To perfection. 5, 8, 3. Have you heard the singing soaking into our transmission? 21, 34, 55, 89, 144. Can you hear the ballet play? into the heart of the universe. Ventricles and atria, chambers number 1597. And counting. And counting. Can you hear?